danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 249 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Owings Mills, Maryland, I'm Andrew Brokus. We're a bit pressed for time this week, Nate and I both, so we don't have a full strategy segment. What we do have for you is more of our awesome interview with Dick Carson. If for some reason you didn't listen to part one of this interview, which is episode 248, I would strongly encourage you to go back and listen to part one. I think there's plenty that you could get out of listening to part two without listening to part one, but not sure why you would want to do that. It'll probably make a little more sense if you listen to it in context, and you'll hear our introduction to, you know, who exactly Dick Carson is. But I guess the real short version is, you know, he's a poker player, or has been a poker player, bookmaker, pool hustler, just a guy who's been around the gambling world going way back, probably as far back as the 1960s. And he was from Texas and was playing poker in Texas in those days. So was friendly with a lot of really legends from that era. Bobby Baldwin, the Binions, Stu Ungar, Chip Reese, those are all names that get mentioned, at least in part one of this interview. And the interview is actually one that we conducted in person. Nate and I both met with Dick Carson and also with John the Lawyer, who's been a guest on the show a few times and has recommended many guests to us. That was also the reason he's friends with Dick, is how Dick got recommended to us. It was John's urging to put this interview together. We all met in a restaurant where we interviewed Dick. So you'll hear a little bit of background noise, and it's probably a little my voice and Nate's voice and John's voice, on the rare occasions that we ask questions, are a little muted because we are sitting further away from the microphone, but you'll be able to hear Dick loud and clear. And if you haven't heard part one of the interview yet, Dick really is a superstar. I mean, just fascinating stories and a great guy. So I hope that you will listen and enjoy. We may not have a strategy segment this week, but we still have a strategy sponsor. For as little as $25 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of tournament poker strategy content at tournamentpokeredge.com. That includes videos from myself and many former guests on the show. Check it out. Little as $25 a month, www.tournamentpokeredge.com.
I'm okay. I'm gonna have some of them wild boar tacos when I eat.
Yeah, we'll get you some tacos
later on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, when you mentioned Spilotro, what was he asking for exactly? How much? What was he trying to get from you?
Never got to that. I was playing poker at the Golden Nugget, and one of his henchmen, Sammy Spiegel, did. Came up behind me in court and said, "Dickie, I need to talk to you." I played Ig. Took me around by the slot machine. He said, "The little man wants to meet with you." What? I knew what he was talking about. The little man was what they called Anthony Spilotro, the ant. He was a little short guy. I remember the movie, Joe Pesci played the part. He said, "The little man wants to meet with you." And that's when I had really started doing well, and I said, "What?" He said, "Come around here a minute." You know, so instead of making a scene at the poker table and saying no, I got up and walked around by the slot machines. Sammy said, we need to get together. He said, "The little man's going to be your partner." So I played Ig again. I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Dickie," exact words, that's a long time ago, but something to the effect, you know, "Don't play stupid with me. You know, we're gonna come out and have a man involved in your operation." I looked at him and I said, "The only partners I got's my wife and kids. And I went back to the poker table. And I went to see Benny Benny. And I went to Dallas, Texas. But I thought about the other alternative first. And I didn't want that on my hands or on my family's hands. And he never gave me a figure because we never had the meeting. But I'm sure it was going to be somewhere between half and 40% or something. Plus, he was going to want to collect money that was owed to me.
Right, which you thought bad for business to have him collect.
Of course it's bad for business. It was going out of style then, and it's really out of style now.
Right.
You mentioned the word tough guy, you get arrested now. Ain't no more of that. At least they sure don't flaunt it. The government won't stand for it. You know, that's... But, no. That's how that went, and you know the story after that. I left.
You went to see Benny, what, for advice?
Told him what happened. Told him what I thought I might do. And that's when he said, you ever heard out of sight, out of mind? I said, yeah, I've heard that saying. Like I say, I learned more from Benny Binion, probably, and Bob Hooks, and maybe even Jack Binion, about the game of life than anybody in the world. Now, bookmaking, I learned more from Bob Martin. But I'd say Benny Binion, I might learn more from him. I learned a lot from Bob Hooks. But there never was a figure because we never got to the meeting.
Was this something you'd been kind of like you were waiting for the shoe to drop? I mean, you knew who he was. You knew he was going to want a piece eventually. Had you been?
I knew it might come.
Had you been thinking about what you were going to do when he did?
No. I was hoping it never came.
Yeah.
It's like a bad dream. But you wake up. I knew that it might come. And if you watch the movie Casino, next time you watch it, take a good look at it. There's a part in there where he's driving a car up to the Gold Rush, which was the name of his, where they kept all the money and the jewelry and all that. And he's high on cocaine in the movie. I don't know about him in real life, but in the movie. And he gets out of that car, and you can hear him. He might as well have called my name. He said, okay, round up every illegal bookmaker, every prostitute, every bellman, every this, every that. We're taking over the streets of Las Vegas. He says it in the movie. If you watch the movie, there'll be a special part where he says that. Right then and there, round them all up. Started out with bookies. Now, I wasn't there, of course. I was home in bed, probably, but that's what he did.
Yeah.
He muscled a friend of mine named Sam Petrillo. From Chicago, who was Italian. I was from Texas. I told him, I was the only partners I've ever had, my wife and kids. And I knew what he was talking about. Don't worry about it. I was playing egg.
So you left town, but your family stayed in Vegas, right?
Yep.
And that was safe?
Well, I had 24-hour watch around that 24-hour guard.
Yeah.
He didn't want nothing to do with my family. He wanted money, you know? I had my kids watch 24 hours a day, taken to school, picked up.
Did they know?
I had security gates. I had cameras. I had a $2 million home, 15,000 square feet.
Was your family aware?
My family was not aware.
But they know now.
Yes, they know now. I shielded my family from all of that, but they all know now. All my wife knew was that I had heat. I didn't even want her to know. I didn't want him to worry.
Right.
Because first of all, I really didn't think that, you know, he just wanted money in reality. But I wanted to make sure that he didn't, I mean, if he'd have showed up 100 yards from my house, I mean, I might have called the FBI and gone right into the office and said, you know, would you like to hear what happened to me? If I thought my children were in danger, you know, I might have, but he never showed back up. My name was never mentioned again. There, it was mentioned once. Has anybody seen Dickie Carson? No, goddamn, what? No. A lot of people knew where I was, but they didn't tell nobody, and I didn't tell them. They heard about it somewhere. you know how people hear, you know, well, he's down in Baltimore playing poker, or he's over to Twin Rivers, or he's wherever, but nobody really knows where he is. But and then he started to lose his, you're just our guest, you know. He started to lose it a little bit, and him and Rosenthal started fussing. That was when it came. They started fighting. And the brains behind the outfit was Rosenthal, not Polacco. That was Rosenthal. So they, when they started fussing, and I started seeing them go down, and their leverage go down, I didn't think I'd be much of a priority. And even when I went back, I didn't go down to the Nugget for a year. I don't think I went down there for a year. In fact, that next tournament I might have gone to was up there in Lake Tahoe. Is that where you saw I won that tournament?
Yeah, February 1983.
Yeah, Lake Tahoe. I might not have gone nowhere until then. And by then, it was all over. I forget what year the bomb was put in Rosenthal's car. Somewhere around there. But I knew that I was of no... That might have been the next time I showed up at Amarillo Slim Super Bowl of Poker where I won that tournament. I stayed at home and I still had my house washed. I still was, I'd like to have the money back I spent on in private detectives.
was that person also shaking down people in the poker world?
Yeah, he shook down, I know a lot of them. I know he shook down Sarge Farris, Chip, Tommy Huffnagel. There's another guy you might talk to. I don't, like I say, I think he's one of the greatest poker players ever lived all around. It's got to be him and Chip Reese that I know of. Now, there may be some new hotshots that I don't know about, but that I know of, I believe Tommy Huffnagel is as good a player all around as anybody unless he's drunk.
He's still alive?
He's worse than me right now, worse off physically, I think. Maybe not. He doesn't have cancer, but he's got... But he'd be a good one to talk to. He's got his brain.
Yeah,
if he would talk to you. He lives in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Hangs around the New Orleans Hotel. Very good friend of mine.
How well did you know Benny Binion?
How well did I know him? He died Christmas Day, 1988. I know that. How well did I know him? I knew him awful well. I knew him well enough that when his daughter died, Barbara killed herself, that we were sitting on the couch and he put his head on my shoulder. And he said, you know, if I'd have been around when she was in high school, things might have turned out different. He went to the penitentiary for income tax evasion when she was in high school. She turned out tough. I knew him that well. I don't know how better I could tell you. That $2,000 he loaned me turned into an open marker. That's all I can tell you. It was open.
Can you tell us the story of how that $2,000 marker happened?
I thought I did. I didn't?
You told us in the car, but we don't have it on tape.
Well, in 1969, they had a tournament in Las Vegas. They didn't call it the World Series, but they called it something else. Johnny Moss was running it, and it was really just a gathering of gamblers from all over the country to play hold'em. Some little deuce to seven. And I was about 22, 23 years old. And I had met Moss at the Redmond's Club back in 1963 or 4 or 5, somewhere right in there. And I played with him, you know, a little bit before he moved out to Reno. He moved to Reno first, then Vegas. And Redmond's Club, was address was 308 and a half South Irby, downtown Dallas. They had one black telephone on the wall. It wasn't there, the phone rang, and Eddie Brown answered the phone and gave it to the guy that was running the Redmonds, whose name was James Eldridge. He's dead. God rest his soul, James Eldridge. And it was Johnny Moss. And the story that I heard was that he said, is the kid around here? I was called the kid. And James said, no, he's not here right now. I think Johnny might have said, is he broke? You know, because, you know, I was in and out of money, you know. I don't remember if James gave him an answer or if he really asked a question. I thought James might have said that. But I showed up there, of course, in a day or two, And James handed me a telephone number to the Horseshoe and a room number. Said, Johnny Moss wants you to call him. So I went over to the payphone, got quarters, put them in and called him. And got him. What are you doing, kid? He said, listen, we're going to have a tournament out here. He said, but it's really going to be a bunch of gamblers playing. We're going to play No Limit. And they ain't played much No Limit out here in Las Vegas. It's all limit poker. And they ain't got no experienced dealers. Now, I had dealt time from time to time at the Redmond when I was broke because I couldn't beat the game. It was all better players than me. And he said, I was wondering if you might want to come out and deal. He said, I think you'll make a few bucks. How you doing? I said, I'm broke. He said, if you want to come out, I said, let me talk to my wife, think about it. He said, well, if you want to come out, you just tell James I said to give you the money for a round trip ticket and go out to the airport and come out here and call the Horseshoe and tell them what time you're coming in, they'll pick you up. And I went and talked to my wife, I was flat broke. Might as well. Las Vegas, I'd been, but so I went out, went down to Redmond and joined, I don't know how much it was, a couple of $100 maybe, $300. To buy a round trip ticket. In those days, you went to the airport, you walked up, you bought the ticket, you got on the plane. Simple. You mean that's your ID. Just got on the plane. So I went out there and I called the Horseshoe and the operator answered. I can't remember her name. She said, I remember you, Dickie. I had been out there when I turned 21. And she said, when you coming in, I'll tell the security. I go to walk outside, there's a whole security car, says Horseshoe Hotel. I got in and went down there. I had 5-6 tables. About the second day I was there, I was dealing in a game, big game. Big game. I don't remember what it was. I think it was stud. It could have been Raz and stud. It could have been whatever. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was 300 and 600, but it was all the high rollers. Johnny Moss, Puggy Pearson, Sarge Ferris, Shoeshine Nick, all the old timers. And like I say, it's been so long that I can't remember verbatim who was playing in the game, but I know they were playing. And I'm just dealing, you know, and I'm dealing away, and a big old pot comes up. Johnny Moss sitting in the one seat, which is next to the dealer. He always sat in the one seat. And a big old pot comes up. I'm dealing the cards. All the bets are in. One card to come, everybody gets one down. So it was either Raz or stud. The last card's down. Somebody bet the limit, somebody raised it. Johnny Moss threw his cards in the fucking air. I think he had the best hand for the last card, but you know, he probably, you know, didn't after he seen a raise and a bet and a raise. And Johnny Moss was a pretty tough guy at the table, whether you know, he was nasty. He was nasty at the table. Away from the table, you're different, but he was nasty. Cursed the dealers, calling everything in the book, firing for nothing. He threw them fucking cards in the air. I don't believe that he even knew I was sitting there. I just come in. And he looked over at me and he said, how in the fuck did you get in the box, you homely looking motherfucker? I started laughing. And I looked at him and I said, you sent me an airplane ticket. Now you talk about laughing. Now, you know, here's somebody's being pushed a $30,000 pot and everybody else is laughing at Johnny Moss. Get up out of that fucking seat. Handed me $1,000 and said, go play in that game over there. And then somebody came and got me and said, you got to go in another table now. I had to give the money back. I think I lost $20. That's the way Johnny Moss was. He never apologized to me, but he didn't have to. That's just the way he was. He misused all the dealers.
Yeah.
All his life.
Was it on that trip that you got close with Benny?
Yeah. That was the trip where he loaned me the 2000. But I got closer to him when I moved out there. When I moved out to Las Vegas is when I got close to Benny.
How did he come to loan you the 2000?
Well, it was that trip, and I was fixing to leave. And, of course, I'd gotten broke the night before shooting craps. And Vinny was in the Sombrero Room, a coffee shop, sitting at his table that he always did, which I had sat with him many a time. I had my bags with me, and I was walking over to the counter. I didn't have to pay for food, and he hollered at me, "Dickie, come over." Sure. I went over and sat down next to him. He said, "Everybody's gone." I said, "Yeah, looks like it's cleaned out of here, Mr. Binion." I asked him, I said, "Y'all don't know what you're going to call this yet." He said, "No, not yet. World Series of Poker, Super Bowl of Poker, we don't know yet." I said, "You think you'll have it next year?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, goddamn, I hope I..." He said, "Well, don't worry about it. You'll be here." And we talked for a few minutes. He said, "How are you getting to the airport?" I said, "I've got enough cab fare," which was $8 then. And he said, "I'll have Bean give you a ride." And he ain't doing nothing. The place was empty. You know, early in the morning, everybody's gone from the poker room. A few people in the casino. He said, "I'll have Bean give you a ride." I said, "Well, that's nice of you." So I ordered breakfast, sat there and ate, and we talked a little bit about some of the poker players like Long Goody and Buchanan and all the old timers and Cowboy Wolford. And we talked a little bit about Bob Hooks and everybody. And we just sitting there ready to go. And Bean came in and said, "Dickie, you better head to the airport. I'll pull a limo up." And I said, "Okay." And I took my hand out and shook Benny's hand. I said, "Thank you for everything." He said, "Dickie, go over at the cage and tell Diane I said to give you a $2,000 marker." I said, "Sir, what?" He said, "Go over at the cage and tell Diane I said to give you a $2,000 marker." And I took a breath. I said, I got $10 or whatever. Wife's going to pick me up. I said, "Mr. Binion," I said, "I got no idea. I sure would look good." I don't remember exactly how I said it. I don't know if I can ever pay you or when I can pay you. He looked at me and said, "I ain't worried about you paying me. You'll pay me. Have a nice trip home." I walked over to Cage. I said, "Diane, Mr. Binion said to give me a $2,000 marker." Her back was to me. She reached over and got the marker and flipped it over to the cage. She said, "Sign it." I said, "Diane, Mr. Binion's over in the Sombrero Room at his table. Would you like to call him and verify it?" She said, "Dickie, ain't nobody got the nerve to come over here and tell me that Mr. Binion told him to give you a $2,000 marker." About 6 years later, I went to Diane and I picked it up. Now, that's how that happened. And a lot went on after that. A lot. The family had troubles. And Benny...
Yeah, that was a sad story.
Yeah, Teddy got killed, murdered. Barbara killed herself. It goes to show you that all the money in the world don't necessarily make it a wonderful life. Not necessarily. It sure can make life easier and happiness easier to look for, but it sometimes don't make it.
It's not a guarantee.
No guarantees. Yeah. Only one.
Were you surprised he got into business? Like he spends most of his time being a businessman, right?
As far as I know.
Yeah. Is that surprising to you?
No. No, when Bobby got licensed, he was the last gambler to get licensed. And when he got his gaming license, it didn't surprise me at all. He's an executive now. I don't know where, number three maybe or number four in the MGM Corporation. I don't know which. He's high up. Technically, Bobby's in a position where. You shut that off.
So in your earlier days, you did some of that road gambling stuff with Bobby Baldwin and those guys? I mean, you were traveling around playing?
I didn't ever road gamble with Bobby Baldwin. I met Bobby Baldwin in, I want to say, 1971 or 2.
Okay.
Could have been 73. And I met him in... I'm not certain whether it was Tulsa, Oklahoma, or the Redmonds, the Amvets, or Corpus Christi. But Bobby and I used to be in Corpus Christi playing poker at a place called a guy's named Sam Moon's house.
Oh.
You know Sam Moon?
He shows up in Old World Series.
Yeah, he's
like, and everybody talks about him as if he's like.
He had a poker game in Corpus Christi.
He got head up or three handed sometime in the early 80s. There's television footage of it.
It's like they're
playing in somebody's basement, you know. Can you change these chips for me? Yeah. You can tell he's one of the guys.
I don't exactly remember. Bobby was a little younger than me. But we played in Sam Moon's game together, and if I remember correctly, we were both struggling, and we had a bankroll up, and I don't remember if we lost it, or it's been so long, I can't remember if we lost it or we won, but it was for a few days, and we stayed there at Sam's house. Sam had a guest room. His wife's name was Jean. She used to fix breakfast every morning. The worst goddamn thing you could eat. Fried pork, fried this, smothered gravy over biscuits, a heart attack waiting to happen. Boy, when you got up, you was ready to eat.
And
it was good. Bobby ran around a lot with Cowboy Wolford. And then after Corpus Christi, Bobby went on back to Tulsa, as far as I know, and I went to Las Vegas. I moved my family to Las Vegas, and then Bobby came out later. Actually, he came out in 78 and won the World Series of Poker. Bobby and I, a good story about Bobby and I would be, we were playing poker at the Horseshoe in 1978, after the World Series of Poker was over, and Bobby had won it. We were playing big stakes hold'em, and all of a sudden we thought gunshots, but they weren't, but we thought they were terrorists, and all of us went on the floor, and all the chips went on the floor. And Bobby and I were on the floor, we were sitting next to one another, laying on $100 chips with our hands over our heads because we thought that terrorists had come in. Well, what had happened was somebody had been kicked out of the Horseshoe for something, which had to be bad if you got kicked out of the Horseshoe. You almost had to commit murder to get kicked out of the Horseshoe. He had taken a baseball bat of some kind and broken the windows that went into the poker room and hit them several times and scared us all to death. Glass all over the place, but we thought they were gunshots. And we're all on the floor. Nobody, I don't think, got the right amount of chips back, but everybody tried to be as right as we could. But if you can imagine, $100 chips, $500 chips, $25 chips, all over the floor, and we're on the floor. We ain't give a shit about the chips. We got our hands over our heads. And that was when the security guard and Teddy Binion chased the kid down the street. They ran out the back door of the Horseshoe and they chased the kid down the street. And so be it, the security guard killed him. And in about 15 or 20 minutes, the police came to the Horseshoe and they broke the cage door down and they arrested Teddy Binion for murdering this kid, which I guess was a big penalty for breaking a window. But anyway, come to find out, the security guard had taken Teddy's gun and killed him. And I forget what they gave the security guard, a year or something. But that Bobby Baldwin and I were sitting right next to each other during that poker game. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. And that was scary. We thought it was terrorists. But don't worry about it. After a while, we all got chips back up. Well, how much did you have? I can't exactly remember. We just started playing again. What the hell? You know, that's the way things were.
Yeah.
It's like getting robbed in Dallas. We got robbed down at the Redmond's Club one night. Me, Bob Brooks, Doc Nichols, Mr. Phillips, and a guy named Red Guernsey robbed us. Funny story about it was I had loaned Red Guernsey $20 in the bathroom. When I went to the bathroom, he said, "Dickie, I don't have cab fare home." And I loaned him $20, and he took the cab fare and went and got a gun, came back and robbed us. And
They say not to loan poker players money, but that's really a parable.
He buzzed, and Eddie Brown, who was the guy that ran the door, let him back in. You know, he came in every day, and he walked in with this gun, and he pointed it right at us. Nice, goddamn. Bob Brooks, who was an old friend of mine, real good friend, said, "Don't get nervous, Red. You know, he's got the gun on us. Don't get nervous." And he took all the money. And he said, "Reach in your pockets and give me all your cash and put it on the table." we did. I don't think we had a lot of money, but whatever it was, a few hundred. Hell, this is 19, could have been 67 or 6. I think Matilda was pregnant with Carolyn. And she was born in 67. So, and Red took all our money and he said, I'm sorry about this, but I got no way out. So Red left and we just started playing on credit. And we found out Red was in jail a few weeks later. And he came back up to the Redmond's Club. I don't know how many weeks later or months later, sat around, was broken down. What are you going to do? I mean, he ain't got nothing to rob. But anyway, there were so many old stories back in Dallas.
Is that one reason there was so much lowball back in the day? They say lowball is a game where cheating is really profitable. Is that, do those two things have any connection to each other? You know, there being some cheats to worry about and there being so much lowball?
There was a lot of cheating going on in lowball. Lowball draw.
Yeah.
Ace to five in California. They don't call it cheating, they call it collusion.
Okay.
It's not as strong as cheating. Some people think it's cheating. Me being a gambler, it's something you deal with.
Sure.
Or if you don't want to deal with it, don't play.
Sure.
It's no different than Trump. He can't get indicted for collusion. You know, you keep hearing this stuff on TV. Collusion is not a crime. I mean, but yes, there used to be people in lowball that would play in together and signal what they had, and it's stronger in a limit game than it is a no-limit game. What I mean by stronger is it's of more value to know that your partner's back there and got a draw to a 7, so you're not going to draw at an 8, or your partner's back there and he's got a draw at an 8-5 and you got a draw at a 7. You don't lay your opponent 2-1 on the money. It's stronger in limit poker than no-limit.
And it's worth more in lowball than in hold'em, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
In hold'em, it ain't worth hardly anything. If you're the two best players in the game, it could be worth. Only time in hold'em it's worth anything, really. Let's say I'm in the big blind. And let's say John's my partner, he's over here. And John's got the 2 jacks.
Yeah.
And I let him know I got 2 aces.
Yeah.
John gets out of the pot.
Yeah.
Because these people will give me more action than they will give John. That's really the only time that it's worth a lot. Actually, if people get onto you, it'll get you broke.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm over here in the big blind and I ain't got nothing, and John's got the 2 jacks, well, of course he'll probably raise the pot.
Yeah.
But if he knows I got a better hand than 2 jacks, then he's not going to come in. He's going to let me play with the people that are going to give me more action.
Yeah.
In no limit, it's not that strong.
Well,
once in a while, if the flop comes 3 spades and I threw away the ace of spades and I tell John, you know, I threw away the nut spade, he might bluff all his money off, but,
yeah.
You know, it's worth something. I mean,
yeah.
But it's not worth near what it's worth in things like stud and him,
yeah,
where you put in extra bets. No limit, you put in extra bet, you put in all your money, you might go broke.
Yeah.
If you're wrong,
yeah.
It's not worth nothing. Actually, Bobby Hoff told me one time, he said, you're better off playing in a different game if you're the best players. In other words, you'll earn more money. If you're the two best players, you're better off playing in different games.
Yeah.
Playing no limit.
Yeah.
Playing no limit.
But, lowball's also a game where if you're marking a card, it's worth a lot more to you. If you're nailing deuces.
Well, you wouldn't nail a deuce, you nail a king, a queen. You can't nail, you want to know when a guy's got a bad hand. You don't want to know when he got a good hand. Got a good hand, he didn't have it.
Yeah.
Well, you care if he's got a deuce, that's a good card. You want to know when he's got an ace, king, queen, ace and deuce to 7.
Yeah.
The only problem with that is that's all over with. It's automatic shufflers. There might be some people that can still do it, but they don't play with the same decks that long.
Yeah.
I've been up against it, I know all about it. I can't see it anymore, I used to could. But the big time cheating now, there is a way that they're big time cheating, and I know about it, and it mostly is in house games. I'm not saying that it couldn't get into a casino, because anything can happen.
Sure.
If anything's taught us in life, anything can happen. But the way they have now is that there's a new way to cheat out, and you have to have the cards in, of course, but you don't have to do any nail marking, and you don't have to do any bending, and you don't have to do any holding out, and you don't have to do any false shuffling. You can use a shuffle and everything. There's a new film that I don't know whether they made in China or where, but that, let's say this is a deck of cards. After the dealer cuts the cards, there's a film. Somebody's in the room. Now, they can be across the street in a motorhome or anything if they have access to the cards through a window or something. As soon as they cut the cards, they know who's going to win the pot. They see down so many cards. They see which hand is going to win the pot. It's the strongest new way to cheat.
Okay.
That I know of.
Sure.
It's only a few years old. They may have come up with something else. Usually it's somebody in the poker room that's playing or on the couch. Somebody that's sitting somewhere where he can get access to the cards after they're cut. And then he signals his players, who's ever in the game, what seat's going to win this pot. You can have an 8 and a 3. You're going to win the pot when the cards are out. That's pretty strong. You know, you're going to win the pot when the cards are out.
It's good to know.
They don't bother with getting everybody's hand. It would take the dealer too long to sit the cards there. They get a film, and as the cards are being dealt around, they see who's going to win the pot. If they go all the way in to the last card. So if you got an 8 and a 3, you play your hand slow, you call a raise, whatever. You know that when the cards are out, you're going to win the pot. Now, if you wind up with a pair of threes, and there's an ace, king, queen on a board, you don't have to show it down. You can make a big bet. You're going to win it anyway. You're going to win the pot. You've got the guy beat. You don't want to show down the 8 and 3. That's the last sophisticated way of cheating I know of. There may be new ways. I'm not up on it. I know it's been done. I know that if they get the cards in a casino, they'd have to get in with the right person and get them when they're delivered, which could be done. I mean, for enough money, people will do anything. You know, I mean, you take a guy that works at the Wynn or works at the Venetian, you know, he makes $40 a day or $50 a day. Guy says, you want to get a hold of $1 million, and it's going to be a shipment of cards come in back there in that truck. It'll be 50 boxes here. Put these 50 in, put those other 50 somewhere else. And they put the cards in the back, and the bosses bring out new cards. As soon as the guy that's in the room has he'll know they're in. It'll come across his film. That's the newest way that I know. Now, I know a million ways, but they're all over the hill. What you're talking about is over with. I mean, I guess if you had a bunch of idiots that didn't know any better, you could do it. But, you know, if every time you catch a king, you get raised, pretty soon you say, what the fuck's going on here? You know. But there used to be a guy named Jimmy Shahadi. He's dead. Really good at it. We used to tell Jack Benyon, Jack, we got to change the deck every 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You want him to play? Yes, we want him to play. He's a terrible player.
Yeah.
We got to change the deck every 15 minutes because he nails those aces and kings, and when he sees them slide across the room. That's why when you're playing poker, and they always have them throw you your card. I'm not saying it's happening. It's a good idea that when your card's coming, have them throw it. Don't have them set it down and push it. That gives them more time to see it if they've got an eye in the sky or a buzzer in the ear or whatever.
It's not rotating.
Yeah,
it's
throw
hard
it.
To pick those things.
And if you're playing draw poker, always keep your hand completely covered. You know, where nobody can see any of your cards. But they used to, years ago, they'd have a peek up. And if you shuffle them, they could see, well, he's got a king in his hand. And he ain't got no king. He's got all little cards in his hand. And then you stayed out of his way. You know, but that's all old shit. That's
over there. They had a problem at the World Series a few years ago. They were using very low-quality cards, and they didn't have enough of them. And players like to squeeze them to get a sweat, and they wound up getting nailed just accidentally.
They had more than that problem at the World Series a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a little problem, though. Ted Forrest won 3 tournaments in a row, you know. And, I guess he was real lucky. In a row.
Yeah.
Pretty good. 4, 5, 6,000 players.
I've always wondered. There's been a couple flashes in the past.
I'm sure he was lucky.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much of that, like people who go on a real hot streak and you never hear from them again, how many of them you just think are real lucky? You never know.
There is such thing as being real lucky.
Yeah.
I believe the luckiest I ever saw was, well, I wouldn't say he was the luckiest because there wasn't that many players, but in 1979, Bobby Puff was playing. What was the guy's name? I can't think of his name. The guy beat him. The guy didn't have no idea. Never played in his life. He had
Noel
never
Furlong.
Played in his life.
Not Noel Furlong.
No. He had never played in his life.
Wow.
And he wound up playing one of the best players in the world. Bobby Hoff was one of the best head-up players in the world.
Yeah.
And he beat him. And it was luck. And Bobby holds that distinction. We used to laugh about it at dinner. I'm the only one that ever lost to, I'll recognize the name as soon as John finds it, 1979.
Hal Fowler.
Hal Fowler,
Bobby Hoff and I used to joke. Bobby said, "Dickie, I'm the only one that ever lost to Hal Fowler." Hal Fowler had never played Hold'em before, and never played in another tournament. And he won the World Series that year. But I believe the luckiest guy that I can remember to ever win it was the guy that won the biggest prize ever. What was his name?
Jamie Gold.
I believe, from what I saw and was told, that he was the luckiest, if it was luck, I presume it was.
Seems like it.
That he drawed out, I mean, him and the other guy, Shoemaker or Moneymaker or whatever it is. I believe those were the two luckiest. You know, Moneymaker had all his money in with it. Wanted to come here to get an eight.
Against Phil Ivey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of lucky there.
They got in pair under pair against...
You know, but I mean, I believe Jamie Gold won the biggest prize that they'll ever be.
Yeah. Although Moneymaker probably actually made more money just from all the...
Yeah, all the hoopla. But Jamie Gold turned out to be an asshole or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what he turned out to be, but...
I've never met him, actually.
He won a lot of lucky pots.
Yeah.
I don't know him either. But... I believe the Moneymaker was lucky to win. I believe those were the two luckiest.
I think we were all kind of lucky that Moneymaker won. I mean, I think that was responsible.
Moneymaker did a lot for poker, didn't he?
Yeah.
He stimulated a lot of people to play.
Right.
But really what poker, when it boomed, was toward the end of my career was 2003.
Yeah.
The internet really made the poker. You know, the internet and the TV, Moneymaker was a big part of it. It boomed off. Now it's peaked out. I think. I don't think it's now. It's just, there's too much of it. You know, it's even the World Series of Poker. I mean, it's not what it was.
No.
I mean, who won it last? I can tell you who won in 1970. Who won it the year before? I mean, the World Series of Poker has really come down a notch. You know, as far as. And furthermore, it's changed so much. I mean, if you win the World Series of Poker, you realize there'd be 6 FBI agents and 6 Internal Revenue agents standing behind you. I mean, I don't know who's going to win it or nothing, but you better have all your eggs in a basket if you win it. You know, it's just everything. It's just become some guy won it from San Antonio, Texas. He either won it or came in second or third several years ago. Can't remember his name. And they took every nickel he had, and at the same time the term was over, they confiscated his home and his car and everything he owned. At the same time, as soon as he won the last pot. Now he owed them, and he was illegitimate. So you better have your eggs in the basket if you want to win the World Series of Poker.
Or just not owe the IRS anything.
Yeah, or not be on illegal business or anything, anything that they can, you know.
But I mean, that used to be almost everybody playing at the World Series of Poker, right? I mean, they all had sort of...
Not in the days when I played.
No?
No.
I think what Andrew means is almost everybody either was a bookmaker or...
Yeah, everybody was an outlaw or something. Yeah.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah, so now it's a completely different set
of
people.
Yeah, I mean, now you got 10,000 people playing, or 8 or 9,000, I mean. And, you know, in the old days, you know, what, 4 played in the first one. 7 in the second one or something, 8.
You 8, 9 mean? Between us, 0 felony convictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, it was completely different. I remember one year the Horseshoe held up the World Series of Poker because the IRS thought that they were entitled to part of the fee to play. And Jack Binion wouldn't give it to him. And he went and got a judge, got rid of habeas corpus, and stopped it. But the Binions are the most stand-up people of all time in the history of owning a casino. There's never anybody, ever, ever as classy as the Binions, and as good to their customers. They, you know, they.
As long as they didn't break windows.
Yeah, no, yeah, you, you were their friend, you were their friend. Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty big penalty that kid got for breaking that window. No, you can't do that in the Horseshoe. But they're the best casino owners I ever knew. And Jack, when he left the Horseshoe, he just went and made more money with the Mississippi and all that. Unbelievable.
Can you share with us some of the wisdom that Chip Reese, that you observed from watching Chip Reese?
Well, I didn't watch Chip Reese as much as I played with him. Chip Reese played all games. The only game that I played with Chip Reese was No Limit Deuce to Seven. Which in the beginning, he was not a good, real good player. But as time went on, he became a great player because he was so card sense. But I can tell you a story about Chip Reese that I remember well. Not that well, but I remember it. And we weren't good friends of any kind. We were business, you know, he played with me on the sports. And we played Deuce to Seven together. And oh, we'd been to dinner together, but we weren't what we'll call really great friends. But Chip Reese was a real pro. If you want to outline Chip Reese, he was a pro poker player. And I was sitting out at the Dunes Hotel one day. I believe it was the Dunes. Could have been the Bellagio, but I believe it was the Dunes. But it was one of those casinos out there, and they were playing stud or mixed games, and I was waiting on a Deuce of Seven game to start. And we were sitting at the table together, and all of a sudden, and right, we were sitting right next to the game, somebody said, let's play 3 and 600. I want to play 3 and 600. I think they were playing 150 or 300. And everybody agreed to change the game. Chip's on the list to get in. Chip turned around at me and said, shit. And I said, well, damn, Chip, you're about the best player in the world. I thought you wanted to play high. He said, it's not that. He said, we'll break the game up. We'll have a 150-300 game every day, 7 days a week, all day. If we change it and start changing it to 3 and 600, we'll lose players, we won't gain any players, and people will get broke quicker. He said, it's better to keep the game at 153. I learned something then, because I didn't play limit. But he taught me that, and I believe I told you that, and I believe you agree with him. And I believe if you were at Foxwoods, you'd want to keep it at 75 and 150.
Yes, a similar thing has happened.
Similar thing, yeah, it's happened. Because when you raise the game, not only does it give the worst player a better chance to get lucky and win and quit, it breaks him quicker also, and then as time goes on, you lose players. I mean, but Chip Reese was a pro. That's the simplest way to put it. He was a pro. Much, much better card player than me all around, 100-1. But I only played two games. In fact, Chip didn't even hardly play Hold'em. That I can remember, once in a while, he might play Hold'em, but not, he didn't hardly ever play. He would play Deuce to Seven when we were playing big enough. But most of the time he played those mixed games or stud. And for all practical purposes, you know, what do I know? I mean, it's like saying Willie Mays is the greatest player ever played baseball. Some people think Barry Bonds. Willie Mays will always get credit for it. Chip Reese might have been the greatest poker player who ever lived, all around. I think that there's people who rival him. I think Tommy Hufnagel's one of them. But Chip Reese was a better manager and a better had control of his life better than Tommy. But so I guess Chip Reese is the greatest poker player who ever lived. I'd have to say it. All-around poker player. That has to be given credit for it anyway. Unless there's somebody I don't know here in the last 30 years. I've been out of the circuit here. And Chip died on December the 4th, 2007. The day that they operated on me in Mexico.
Same day?
Same day.
Wow.
My daughter peeked in the door while the girls were shaving me.
Oh, she told you before your operation that your friend had just died?
Saw it on the internet.
Yeah, I think she might wait until after your operation was over to
tell you. She said, you're doing better than one of your friends, Dad.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have to come out of it. They said, just come across professional poker player Chip Reese, who had been to my house,
right,
who she knew. She's 50 years old. Died. I said, what? Died of pneumonia a few hours ago. December 4th, 2007. I believe that's the date. You can look it up.
You know it was late 2007.
I was in Cancun, Mexico. Getting broke up against the knife. Not the knife, but the ultrasound.
Yeah.
8 hours I was out. 8 or 9. 10 years later, it comes back.
Would you say that Billy Baxter or Doyle Brunson was a better Deuce the Seven lowball player? Or you? Or somebody else?
That's a hard question to answer. It's not me. It's probably Doyle Brunson. Billy Baxter won more tournaments. And for some reason, and I don't know how he did it, but he won tournament after tournament. But I believe Doyle Brunson was the best 2-7 player in a ring game that I ever played with. There were some other good players, Aubrey Day, who you don't know, who was from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He was a real tight player. It was hard to win his chips. If you're playing 7 or 8-handed 2-7, and it's real hard to win somebody's chips, they're a good player. It was hard to win Aubrey Day's chips. Now, Doyle was probably a better player, but Aubrey Day was a good player. Don't think he wasn't.
Now, can I get you those tacos?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll take those 7 players that you consider that good. Johnny Moss was a good 2-7 player. But Johnny Moss could play anything, no limit. But Johnny Moss was past his prime. He didn't play that much with us when we played big.
Did Puggy Pearson ever play?
Puggy Pearson was not a good 2-7 player. He played once in a while, but he was not a good player.
Bobby Baldwin?
Bobby Baldwin was a good player. Bobby Baldwin was a good 2-7 player.
What's the biggest 2-7 game you played in?
Well, the biggest 2-7 game I ever played in was a 1,000 ante, $2,000 and $4,000 blind.
No limit.
That's the biggest game ever. But that was only in one or two occasions.
I should think so.
Most of the time we played 400 ante, $8,000 and $1,600 blind, or 300 ante, $4,000 and $800 blind, or 500 ante, $1,000 and $2,000 blind, or if certain players wanted to play, we would play 200 ante for them. But the biggest game I ever played in, other than a tournament, can't count a tournament, was 1,000 ante, $2,000 and $4,000 blind. I think Larry Flint was in the game. And maybe Bob Stupak, I don't remember. But that's the biggest game I ever played in, a regular poker game. Now, I've been in a tournament where I had more chips than that, you know, and blinding it for 60,000, but that can't count that.
Would the 1,000, 2,000 game go 15 times in a year or more, less?
500 ante?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
How often would you guys play that game?
Well, we might play that once every 2 or 3 weeks. Most of the time we play 300 ante or 400 ante.
Did Steve Wynn play in those games?
No. Steve Wynn, I can't remember ever playing 2-7. Only remember him playing Hold'em and never too big. I don't remember Steve Wynn playing too big. Maybe 10 and a quarter, 25 and 50 maybe. Mostly 5-10 at his place. No, Steve Wynn was not a... He played mostly in his place, and he didn't play big.
He was saying he was good with marketing in the beginning by always taking the 5 seat. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, it was right in the middle of the table. He could see everybody that came in the casino that headed toward the poker room. Everybody could see that Steve Wynn was in the game, and he was a big name, and he just bought the Nugget. And I guess that's part of marketing. A lot of people on the rail, good for the game. He was a bad player in the beginning, and he got to be better. Never was a good, great player of any kind, but he got to be better.
Did you ever play with the owner of the Dunes? Was it Sid Wyman?
Yes, I played with Sid Wyman.
Tell us about some of those games.
Those games were back when I was barely old enough to get into Las Vegas. I played with Sid Wyman at the Dunes, probably 1967, 8. Sarge Ferris, Johnny Moss, old-timers played, Jack Strauss. We weren't playing that big then. I think we were playing 2-7, but it might have been $50 ante. Trying to think who else was out there. I can't remember all the names, but there was old timers. Who in the hell else played out there? I can't. Johnny Joseph played, who was from Austin, Texas. But the big Deuce to Seven was down at the Horseshoe. The real big, mostly, was real big, was at the Horseshoe. Billy Baxter and I played big head up, which he beat me more than I beat him.
That was real big head up.
400 ante, 1600 blind, 500 ante, 1000 and $2,000 blind. I beat him one night for 250, but I think he's winner over me overall. But he was probably a better player than I was, now that I look back on it. But I had a lot of money, and I didn't want to play anything else. There wasn't anything else to play, really. They started playing Omaha. They killed the Hold'em when they started that stinking Omaha.
Story of my life.
They started playing Omaha up at High Sierra at the Amarillo Slims tournament, and it killed the Hold'em. You know, there's more skill to Hold'em than Omaha, in my opinion. And I never got to play in Omaha, so everybody wanted to play Omaha. And the people who had sense, and I didn't need poker. I didn't have to play poker. I had a sports book and was betting and was doing well then. I played poker to play. And that's the reason I mostly played Deuce to Seven then. It was my favorite game and my best game. And I had money to play with and I could play high. And I really didn't need to play 1500 hold'em. You know, but the Omaha killed it. And I remember about 1985 up at the High Sierra, they all started playing Omaha. Pretty soon it was Omaha, Omaha, Omaha. And there were some good players in Omaha. I know them. I didn't play with them, but I knew who they were. Barry Johnson was one. Garland Pollard was one. And O'Neill Longston was one. And there were some good Omaha players. And evidently, the reason that they wanted to play Omaha was because the bad players would play Omaha because it gave them a better chance to win. You know, you can hardly get anybody up against the nuts in Omaha. Whereas in Hold'em, you can almost, you know, hem them up pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, whereas in Omaha, you can't hardly get anybody up against the nuts. Pretty hard. I mean, I know two aces is still a favorite, but you give me, well, you got 8, 9, 10 jack, and I got two aces, a deuce, and a seven. I don't know how big a favorite two aces are. They're a little bit, but not much.
Yeah, it's not like Hold'em aces versus 9, 8.
No, they're not much. I think Fran looked it up for me one time. They're a little bit, but not much. I'd be scared to death put all my chips in there. You got 7, 8, 9, 10. I got two aces, 8, and a deuce. I don't know how much of a favorite it is, but it ain't much.
It's very small. There are a couple rundown hands that are even a favorite over dry aces.
What are they?
I think it's 8, 9, 10 jack double suited against very dry aces. It's a small favorite.
Well, I can tell you what I asked Chip Reese. I forgot to tell you this story. I asked Chip Reese one time. I asked him, I said, if you were playing Omaha and you could get the same four cards every deal, which four would you take? He said, I'd take the ace and jack of spades and the ace and ten of hearts. Now, that's what he told me. What do you think?
Sounds good to me. Ace, ace, jack, ten, double, six.
I'm talking about every deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's...
I think that sounds right.
That's better than two aces and kings.
I mean, I would trust his opinion over mine anyway.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound
that's
wrong.
That's better than two aces and two kings?
I would think so. I don't think the kings are doing that much for you.
Is it better than the ace queen and the ace jack? He said ace jack and ace ten.
Yeah.
And I presume it's because the jack and the ten can make more straights.
Straights,
yeah.
Where the 7, 8, 9 come into play, more so than if you've got kings. I guess, I don't know. But he said he'd like to nail them four down and try to play some Omaha.
I guess you'd rather your opponent have a queen high flush than a nine high flush,
yeah.
Or than a ten high flush.
I mean, like, a set ain't nothing in Omaha. It ain't nothing unless you make four of a kind. I guess a pair of the board, but I mean, I guess it's something if you pair the board, if you've got the top one. But, and I was also told that there's no flush in Omaha but the nuts.
Yeah.
There is none. It ain't like Hold'em where you can bet the king high flush when the cards are out for value. You better show it down in Omaha. I mean, I know how to play the game, but I would never play it. I mean, I know what the best hand is.
That's going to do it for part two. We've got about another hour of Dick Carson coming up for you on episode 250. Can't wait to share that with you next week. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you want.